Coming up on another exciting installment of That Was a Show. 1987 saw the release of the Academy Award-winning film Harry and the Hendersons. That Oscar was for makeup and hairstyling, which makes sense when you consider that the star of the story is in fact a Bigfoot. It was adapted into a sitcom a mere 4 years later. Both were produced by Amblin Entertainment, best known as the Spielberg-helmed production company responsible for another 1980s family meets fantasy creature drama, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, the image of which is right in their logo. This very hairy show replaced John Lithgow and Melinda Dillon with Bruce Davison and Molly Cheek as the parents of a family who happen upon a friendly Bigfoot and adopt him into their family. Bryn, Aaron, and Barry go on a hike in the Pacific Northwest and try to determine if Harry's feet are in fact too big. We grew up during peak sitcom, Seinfeld, Friends, The Fresh Prince, but those shows were diamonds in the rough. This podcast is not about those diamonds. It's about the rough. Some sitcoms were briefly popular in their time. Some were canceled almost immediately. You probably won't recognize most of these, and you'll ask, that was a show?
That was a show?
The podcast about failed or forgotten sitcoms from the 80s and 90s, starring
Bryn Burney,
Aaron Yeager,
and Andrew Helmer as Barry.
A Radio Gizmo production.
Throat is doing something weird, so we'll see how that.
You sound okay. You have a lot of mystique.
Oh, good. That's the goal.
You sound kind of just gravelly and like
Barry, the phone sex operator.
Yeah.
Oh, geez, we're coming in hot.
You've got like a whole like gravelly, hard scrabbled kind of sound, you know?
Hard scrabbled, like a noir detective. Yeah,
exactly.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
That's the classier version than where I went with the phone sex operator.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Both can, that's a thing for somebody, you know?
I guess they're not mutually exclusive.
No.
No, I mean, you know, private and public dicks, really.
Oh, shit. We're really on a roll here on this Thursday night.
Thursday night.
Yeah.
Thursday night.
It's weird. So everybody out there, if our energy is weird, it's because we're all tired and we worked all day.
And we have to work tomorrow morning.
And we have to work tomorrow morning.
Everybody listening to this is like, shut up. I'm working right now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're like at their desks. Like,
yeah. Normally we record, we have a routine where we record Sunday mid-afternoon.
Yeah.
It's a very like ideal time for energy level and not having to like think about other things that are going on. But for reasons that are not interesting enough to include in this conversation, we're recording Thursday night primetime television.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. Yeah.
So, without further ado,
let's get into this.
Oh, please. I wish there was so much more ado before we had to talk about this.
Well, I will say it's a here's a tiny bit more ado. It's a while since we've done a bad adaptation. And
yeah, that's for sure. I got to remember to plug in the little bad adaptation artwork.
Yeah.
Yeah.
and it wasn't specifically in the game plan. We weren't like, it's not like we all discussed, hey, let's find another bad adaptation. But as I was going through the list of shows that we had sort of vetted and mulled over and figured that we would eventually talk about, this one stuck out.
Yeah.
And so here we are.
Here we are.
All right.
But we didn't say what it is yet. Go for it, Aaron.
Well, they probably know what it is because they clicked on the little doohickey play the...
You know, out of all these episodes, it never occurred to me that when we try to build mystique behind the show that we're covering, it's never once occurred to me that people know because they clicked it already.
Yeah, I guess so.
You both thought that there was an element of surprise?
No, I don't know. I don't even know. Well, right, no,
you know me. I'm not a podcast guy. I don't know anything about him.
Well, here we go. The 39th most popular movie in 1987 was a family comedy called Harry and the Hendersons, starring John Lithgow. Here's the tagline from the poster. According to science, Bigfoot doesn't exist. When you can't believe your eyes, trust your heart.
Did they give up on the tagline halfway through it and just change to a new tagline?
So there you have it. That's the actual tagline. And according to that movie, I mean, you could summarize the entire premise as Bigfoot exists. So, but to expand on that, Harry is the Bigfoot and the Hendersons are the family who rescues him from a hunter bent on proving the existence of this mysterious creature through killing him. So a few years later in 1991, Amblin Television, that's Steven Spielberg's production company. And now actually I'm surprised they didn't attempt a sitcom adaptation of E.T. instead if they wanted to do a paranormal creature. But anyway, so Amblin Television decides that the world needs more Harry. So they went with this, and that leads us to our latest bad adaptation episode. But was it bad? It lasted 72 episodes, which is a pretty decent run by today's terms, although fairly short-lived by early 90s standards. The man inside the Bigfoot suit is Kevin Peter Hall, the same actor who played Harry in the feature film. He's also 6'9", so I'm assuming that's a factor. And prolific actor Bruce Davison replaces John Lithgow as George Henderson. The jumping off point is similar, if perhaps a bit more innocent. The Henderson family is on their way home from a camping trip and accidentally hit a big animal with their car. They think they killed it and strap it to the roof of their car, bring it home, and call animal control to deal with it. It looks kind of like a Bigfoot, but it couldn't be. Or could it? In the movie, they bring the animal home knowing it's some sort of Bigfoot and hoping it will bring them fame and fortune. In both cases, the creature turns out to be alive and escapes from the ropes on the roof of the car. The family realizes the Bigfoot is actually caring, non-threatening, and intelligent. In the movie, they release the creature into the wild, but then discover a hunter is out to kill him, and they manage to protect him, etc., etc., yada, yada. In the show, they adopt him into the family almost immediately. And that gives us a pretty good jump start on episode one, so I'm going to go right into that. Initially, when they find the Bigfoot in their home, they figure he's probably a threat and freak out. The Bigfoot has gotten a hold of their son Ernie, and it's not entirely clear if he's holding him to protect him or as some sort of hostage. In any case, the animal control guy is there, and he turns out to be a cryptozoologist, if that's a real thing, named Walter...
Very much is.
Okay.
Okay.
Named Walter Potter, who specializes in researching paranormal animal phenomena or something like that. And he becomes a sympathetic ally to the family and to the Bigfoot, who turns out to be friendly and caring. Bigfoot has an injured leg that they tend to. And then we also meet their neighbor, who's a local news anchor, Samantha Glick. And she's also a single mother to a little girl, Tiffany, who goes to school with their son, Ernie. We also meet a local police officer who's on the lookout for a supposed Bigfoot on the loose that a local hunter claims to have taken a shot at. So that's where Bigfoot's leg injury clearly came from. And they agree to let him stay with them to hide out and protect him from the hunter and from the cop. And he becomes part of the family.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, before we get into the whole silliness of it all, I have to say, just like as a pilot, it really moved. Like it really got into the action. Bang, bang, bang. Like, you know, he got in with the family right away. Like everything happened. It was like a very efficient
pilot.
Very
efficient.
And I felt like it was 5 minutes long, but it was like, you know, a full length pilot, like sitcom pilot.
Got a lot of characters introduced.
Yeah. I was like very impressed just structurally how that thing moved.
Yeah.
Like I was like, it was written at a good pace and it was like edited at a good pace. It was like, you know, just Yeah, you didn't have time to suspend your disbelief.
Yeah, like, yeah.
Like, and maybe that was by design because they knew a lot of people would be like, what is going on? It's like, he immediately lives there.
One of my notes very early on was like, this premise is so ridiculous, but the execution is actually pretty good. Like, if you're going to do a show where a Bigfoot moves in with a family,
yeah,
this is how you do the pilot for that. Like, this is how you fucking crash land into that premise and just say, boom, here it is. Take it or leave it. Like, boom, we're in there.
Yeah.
Oh, 100%. I mean, you know, out of the way, like, this is, and we haven't covered that many of them, but we've covered a few of them. This is very much a family sitcom, and not in the way that it's about a family, but this is very much for young. It's not a, you know, it's not for the Friends crowd. This is, you know, it was aired in first run syndication. So it was basically playing in the afternoon for kids. Right. Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty dumb. It's also pretty harmless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the effects on Harry himself, despite being on a TV budget, are pretty impressive. Like all the prosthetics for his facial reactions are all there.
Pretty solid.
You know, Harry's, you know, terrifying one way or another. I mean, I'm just going to go with this. This feels like this feels like one of those weird pop culture things that Aaron is somehow unaware of. Like Aaron didn't see Harry and the Hendersons growing
up.
Did you not
see the movie?
I was aware of it. Okay. I don't know that I ever watched.
I feel like I've talked about it 1,000 times around
I don't know if I ever watched the movie or the show before, but I was certainly aware of it. I will say, I don't remember when, but not that long ago, I remember watching the first
couple. No,
I was going to say, I just watched the first couple episodes. The closest comparable show around the same time has to be Elf. And I remember a couple of years ago, at some point when we were working on this podcast, just out of curiosity, watching the pilot of Elf and the first couple episodes.
And had you also
terrible.
You had not seen Elf either, right?
I had seen bits and pieces of Elf throughout the series in syndication as a little kid.
Okay.
But I certainly didn't watch it in order from the beginning. The Elf pilot was terrible. By comparison, this destroys it. This is such a better produced pilot.
It's just a well produced, like you said, it's just because it's so well produced and well put together that it's just clean. It's just very clean. It's just very
this
like,
engine is running, you know, on all cylinders.
Yeah. Like, who are the line producers on this thing?
I don't know.
Like,
you know, Amblin Entertainment, especially in the early 90s, you know, the quality children's programming was a big thing for Spielberg. You know, he was, you know, they were behind Animaniacs. And,
right.
You know,
was like the best show.
It was.
Yeah.
It's a long time since we've reviewed, like you said, like a family show, not a show about a family, but a family show. It's actually quite a while since we've reviewed a sitcom like this. And so, yeah, I have to put on a different hat to think about it as like, was this good for the intended audience, which is not necessarily me, because we watched the first episode and we usually jump ahead to like a season two or season three or a last episode or whatever. And for one reason or another, I thought this time, let's just watch episodes 1 and 2. I want to see how they build on this premise back to back. And I got to say, like, again, they kept it tight.
Yeah,
those were two solidly produced episodes of television. If you're willing to accept that a family would just almost sight unseen, with very little thought and consideration, have a Bigfoot move in with them and live with them and their kids. If you're willing to accept that, and you know I'm usually the one who's grumpy about stupid premises, but this is a kids show, so I'm willing to say, let's say we put that aside, pretty well-made show.
Yeah.
Big fan of getting midway through episode 2, and the writer is sitting there and like, realizes, oh shit, nobody's called him Harry yet. We're in mid-episode 2. Nobody's even, and I'm like, you guys didn't have like a throwaway line in the pilot.
That's
you actually
Harry.
Had to,
yeah.
Yeah, so
you
because
had to make
he's
a
Harry.
Big, yeah.
Because he's hairy.
He had to make a big deal of it yeah. in the second episode. Really?
Yeah. They had a whole scene that really made a meal out of why yeah. he's called Harry.
Yeah.
It's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to the first episode. Okay. Let me just say, though, there was a, you know, it's one of those kids shows where there's clearly also certain jokes or plot points that are there for the parents watching with the kids sort of thing that like little references that like at the time, like a baby boomer parent might laugh at that are not necessarily for the kids. My favorite was Dad's dialogue on the phone. I don't know if you caught this, Barry. Maybe you did. Dad's dialogue on the phone call at the beginning, trying to get animal control to come out. This is when they still think that the creature, they don't know quite what it is and they think it's dead. He's on the phone with animal control and it's a straight up, like line by line ripoff from the Monty Python dead parrot sketch. One of the lines is, mm-hmm. I know a dead animal when I see one. Well, I took its pulse. Nothing. Dead. Deceased. This is a late animal. And the way he just like lands that last sentence, this is a late animal, the pacing, the phrasing is exactly John Cleese. This is a late parrot from the dead parrot sketch, like
nope,
line by line.
Didn't catch that.
And that's clearly like a very specific reference that the writer put in for themselves. Like that was just a writer amusing themselves and yeah. hoping that 1% of the audience got it.
I would say that it all makes a little bit more sense now because, like, I already thought the line of I took its pulse was yeah. weird because I'm like, well, you can only take, like, a Bigfoot type animal's pulse or a monkey. Like, you don't know how to check an animal's pulse on any other animal.
Yeah.
But now that it's a Monty Python joke yeah. about a parrot. That's funny because clearly you didn't check a bird's pulse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whereas in this, it doesn't. It's like he's giving away the game.
Yeah. Yeah. I had to rewatch that scene to remember. Because when he said this is a late animal, I was like, wait a second. Where do I recognize that line from? And then I rewatched and I was like, oh, this is a deliberate Monty Python reference.
Like, how did they get him on the car is what I want to know. Like, he probably weighs
not,
like
not important.
It's not. You know, I guess not. And
the little kids didn't help.
You know how he got him on the car? They were discussing it in production and we're like, how do we get him on the car? And they're like, I got it. Scene starts with him on the car.
We don't see it. We don't see it.
And this is definitely a problem that could only exist in 1991 because, you know, if this were happening present day, we would obviously Google whatever and there'd be videos of the Bigfoot on TikTok already. And they would find the number for animal control and just call on the road and they wouldn't be taking the animal home with them. Which already was kind of wild, like, that they did that back then. But yeah, this is definitely, like, a sitcom from the 90s logic. Not just sitcom logic, sitcom from the 90s yeah. logic. Because, yeah, that's literally yeah. the only way that this scenario yeah. could really yeah. work
but
at all.
Now, to go back to the production values, again, like, opening title sequence felt kind of like of a cinematic nature. Like, not...
Yeah.
Not super amazingly made, but just like the type of photography, the type of titles felt like an 80s, like a late 80s movie type of lead in. The music, everything, like it seems to be a single cam show. And the just like, yeah, the way it could, because like obviously episode two, you know, we get into that song that, you know, is very recognizable.
No, they played it in both.
Oh, they did play it in both.
They played it in both, yeah.
They play the full-length version of it in the pilot.
Right.
And
right.
then in the second episode, they mercifully shortened it to about 30 seconds.
That's how you know, guys. That's how you know the tone of the show when they play
yeah.
that Randy Newman okay. style.
I know why.
What genre of music is yeah. that? Like,
we got big feet.
My feet's too big. But like... It's
that was so popular in the early 90s.
I know why I forgot that was in the pilot, because the music that was more memorable, like burned into my memory from the pilot, was the underscore that played throughout the rest of the episode, which was more like movie music, like more like movie scoring. Mm-hmm. And like just the pacing.
Amblin Entertainment, once again.
The lighting is like kind of hard, low key lighting. The whole pilot episode takes place at night. And it look like, I gotta say, like, you know, I always make fun of the overly lavish sets that some sitcoms have. But in this case, it kind of makes sense. Like, this is supposed to be like kind of an upper middle class family in the Pacific Northwest.
It's a great house.
Near Seattle. It's a banger of a house. Like, this is like a chalet. Also,
you need room for Harry to wander around.
Exactly. Those tall ceilings
you need the tall ceilings.
Much needed. I remember that, like, as soon as I started watching it, it really took me back. I was like, oh, yeah, I remember this house. Yeah. I remember thinking this house was sick as a kid.
It is a sick house.
Absolutely. I have a bit of a Mandela effect with this show I believe I remembered watching it and, you know, because I liked the movie quite a bit as a kid. So I watched the show, obviously. And I honestly could have sworn that it was Max Wright in the lead instead of Bruce Davidson. Like, you know, like Max Wright, like the lead from Elf. And I was just like, is this like an alternate universe that I'm remembering where like there's this version? Because I can distinctly remember him being like,
you're fusing the shows together.
Yeah.
I mean, I
believe it. Or what about, or
you
Charles
know, I was
Grodin.
You know who I was actually picturing? It's weird that you say this now. This is kind of spooky because I also had a similar thing. But it wasn't, it was not that dad. It was the dad from Family Ties that I was picturing.
Oh.
Well, what's his name? And he was like too old to be that dad at that time. But anyway, weird.
There's a weird beat that I noted where.
Just one?
I mean, there are many, but the one that I found the most off-putting was when the animal control guy comes in and immediately their daughter's swooning over him so fast in such a weird way.
That was a bit of a trope for early 90s, where it was just like horny teen daughter.
Like, has an inappropriate crush on an adult man. Yeah.
But it's the speed with which it went down was kind of as if it was like someone who was like, you know, starving and suddenly food was put in front of them. Like, she just like immediately runs at this guy. And I'm just like, what? Like, this guy? Him?
I mean, she has very specific taste.
Very specific.
Yeah.
She's into cryptozoology.
Apparently, yeah. I want to call out another trope while we're at it. It's the, what I like to call the trope. So anytime there's like a creature, which was, you know, way more common than you'd think in the 80s and 90s, there's always that moment where the humans are scared of the creature for the first time. They're caught by surprise.
Yeah.
And there's immediately this kind of comedic scream where they look at the creature looks at them, everyone's just
and the joke is always that the creature is just as scared them as they are of it, which in this particular case definitely delivered. Like, and I will give a shout out to the actor who plays Harry. He really does a fabulous job working that costume.
Yeah, totally. And like, you know, the voices,
he also played the Predator.
He did. Yes. I know. Yeah.
He did.
There's some fun facts about the various Harrys.
Fun and not so fun.
He was Harry in the movie too.
Yeah.
And
he was only the first season.
The first season, because he passed away.
Yeah. But he does a great job of working that costume. I mean, like, I have to say, for a giant like hairy creature in a sitcom, there's a lot of performance in the face and the actions.
That's for sure. And actually,
that's Harry's magic.
Yeah, totally. But that I was telling you, Aaron, like I've been going down, I go down the weirdest rabbit holes, and probably all the listeners know this by now. I go through these phases where I'm really into a very specific like type of entertainment and I just like do a lot of it on a binge. And this week, for whatever reason, it's been watching all the live action Disney remakes of like the movies from the 90s.
Oh, and, interesting.
And all the one thing that's been disappointing. So I did enjoy them all. I really loved The Little Mermaid. I found it very entertaining. But a lot of the animal or like humanoid creatures that are featured in these batch of movies, they're too realistic looking and they don't have enough humanoid characteristics. And this is something that they definitely nailed more in the 90s because it was, I think, in my opinion, because it was more practical effects, right? You're putting like a costume on a person and you're like, you know, whereas like now it's all CG and it's all like,
or hand-drawn animation where it's like,
yeah,
if you're going to make it compelling, you have to go way more cartoonish and whimsical.
Well, yeah. they're taking the personality out of the animal characters. I mean, the Lion King is soulless and it's just like, it's like, why they called The Lion King an anime, like the remake an animated movie, or why they called it a live action movie. You were like, well, all the performances are CG. You just made them look real. So now it just looks weird because they're not emoting.
Exactly. Well, it's similar in these other movies, Barry. It's similar in Little Mermaid with like Flounder and Sebastian. I'm like, I just want to see more character in their faces. Like, that's the whole point of it, right? Because it's, you need that whimsy. It's for kids. It's for families, you know? Like, you need, I don't want a realistic looking flounder fish. I want, like, a little bulbous, chubby flounder like the cartoon, you know?
It seems to be a pretty common refrain with these things. That does tend to be the most common complaint about them.
Yeah. And the voice at work is fun. Like, they choose fun people to be the voices of these characters, and you don't really get that. It doesn't come through in the same way.
Yeah.
The acting
and singing and all those things will be great, but I know what you mean. It's like there's a certain weird, whimsical cartoonishness in the 90s that, I don't know, even whether it's a remake or whether it's a new movie, there seems to be reluctance to go that route.
I do
some
think
things now.
I do think Harry definitely like nailed it. Like both the performer and the craftspeople, like the design of the character, I think they really nailed it. Actually, like it's a rare thing, and
it looks great.
It's probably, again, Amblin Entertainment.
Yeah, it's in the league with like a Jim Henson level of puppetry, in a sense. Obviously, it's not a
100%,
puppet.
100%.
It's not a puppet, but like it's that league of quality.
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, I mean, there's some animatronics going on in there. It must be, right? I mean,
the way
the face moves, it's not done completely by the actor.
No.
It's impressive.
The one thing, Barry, that I, when I was watching, I thought you probably got a kick out of was the little bit where they're purring at him, and then he's about to like purr back, and then he's just like, meh.
He just
dismisses them and turns around and keeps going about his business in a surly way.
I think my absolute favorite bit, and it's the best performance in the entire two episodes we watched, comes at the end of the first episode. And you don't often get a call out to this, but the best performance has to go to the studio audience, who uproariously clapped and cheered when they decided they were going to keep Harry. And you're just like, what did you think you were watching? We're watching the pilot for Harry and the Hendersons. Yeah, they're going to keep him.
Yeah, of course they're going to keep, well, obviously.
They're like, I know. Yeah. It's sweet. It's all... They were coaxed, but I'm like, all right, guys, like, let's,
you
let's
think
tone
these
it
people
down.
Were not coached to get that reaction.
Yeah, exactly.
Bruce Davison is, he's done a lot of roles.
Yeah, well, we'll get into it in the spinoff.
We'll get into it in the spinoff.
He's got like 272.
272.
Well, and he's hitched his wagon to the asylum's chariot recently.
But
so
272 credits and 10 upcoming.
Yeah. No, the man never stops.
I don't know how old he is.
Well,
but he's,
he does. Like I said, he does. He works with the asylum, and the asylum will have him shoot a day.
I don't know what those
we don't
words
know what
are.
That is.
What
is the asylum guys? A show?
The asylum is a very infamous production studio that has since the 90s put out basically. If Transformers is in the movie theaters,
yes.
Transmorphers is on the shelf.
Okay, that's why he was
Titanic and Titanic 2.
Yeah,
He works with them.
Mockbusters.
And what they do is they'll get him in, shoot, and Eric Roberts, big one for them too. They'll get him in, shoot him for an afternoon, and then just like first billing, you know, 3 minutes of screen time, boom.
What a gig.
Gives the asylum a little bit of push forward. And then, you know, I guarantee you he's probably just making scale. Like, they're not paying him like rate.
I didn't know what the studio was called.
Oh, they're huge. They're still huge.
No, but I've been aware of this for a while. I've been aware of these like terrible mockbusters for a while, but I just didn't know what the studio was called. Is that like Shane Van Dyke's company?
Shane Van Dyke? Who's that?
Dick Van Dyke's like grandson. Because he was like the king of the mockbusters for a long time.
Maybe.
This is a whole other conversation.
It's a whole other conversation.
But,
and to be fair, he also does other more mainstream.
No, it's not. Not him. No.
Interesting.
So there's it's a rival company then.
these guys are the big ones.
Okay. Yeah. The big dogs.
They're the Sharknados. You know.
Okay. There's one more story beat I want to call out before maybe introducing what episode two is about, and that's the cut, the hard cut. This is at the point in the episode where we're going from, oh, Harry might be this like threatening creature that they should be fearful of, to, oh, he's actually like smart and friendly and loving and he's going to become part of the family. It's such a quick transition. It's almost as if there's a couple of scenes missing, because it goes from like him like dropping their son on the floor and seeming to be like, oh, I'm not out to hurt anyone. And then it's hard cut to Harry sitting with their son reading a storybook, and the parents are like watching from the couch and happy and smiling, and everything's all good. And it's just like, oh, it's as if he's like immediately like almost like just part of the family already. Like, it's just such a fast boom. Like, talk about plot moving.
Yeah.
Moving.
Yeah.
Should I intro episode two?
Go
God, please.
Episode two begins the next morning and is called, appropriately, The Day After. Dad wakes up thinking he just had a crazy dream and they brought home a Bigfoot who now lives with them. It turns out to be true. The news anchor neighbor comes over with her daughter, and the family manages to keep the Bigfoot away from her. But her daughter accidentally catches a glimpse of him in the backyard. Dun, dun, dun. Anyway, meanwhile, as Barry mentioned earlier, they end up naming the Bigfoot Harry because he's hairy. And so that's a important scene. And the main plot of the episode is that the kids need to go to school and both parents need to go to work, but somebody needs to stay home and supervise Harry because they still don't quite trust leaving him home alone, presumably mostly for his own safety, but also so the secret doesn't get out, for a whole bunch of reasons. They don't want to just leave him alone unsupervised. Mm-hmm. So Dad ends up being the one stuck at home, but he has a big important presentation at work, as all 1991 businessmen wearing a tie do.
Yeah, there's always a presentation.
So
he's got to do a business.
He has to do a business. So he gets increasingly frustrated and he's panicking. His big business is coming up in an hour. How's he going to get out of there? And
still don't know what he does.
Yeah.
Not really, but there are a couple of context clues, and I looked it up online, but it's sort of woven in there. it seems like, and I think this is actually the same thing as in the movie, he works at like a sporting goods company, like in kind of like sales and marketing or something for like,
what?
I don't know if it's probably not just a store. It's probably like a chain of stores or like a bigger sort of sporting goods brand or company, something like that. A lot of this stuff has to do with like, you know, the forests outside Seattle in the Pacific Northwest and camping and outdoorsy stuff. anyway, he gets increasingly frustrated. Various comedic antics occur. And in the end, George realizes that he can learn a lot from Harry about valuing what's important and not getting completely caught up in his job. And we can talk more about that scene later. But that's episode two.
Woohoo.
It sure was. Episode two is my goddamn nightmare. It is just people dropping by your house unexpectedly. Actually, this whole show is just people stopping by with no warning or regard for whatever you're doing.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. And I would say that it's not realistic, but actually in certain contexts it is, like at my parents' house, like not so much these days in the post kind of COVID world, but like before that, they had pop-ins constantly.
Yeah.
It drove me mad.
Oh, it's a real thing. I don't invite it into my life.
Yeah, I know. Everyone knows they have to text me if they're, you know, in the area and want to pop by. Everyone knows they have to text me ahead of time.
There's a lot of cramering going on. A lot of cramering. A lot of nosy neighbors popping in, but it's not as zany as most sitcoms play it. Like the pop-ins are in some ways more matter of fact, which probably is what makes them for you, Barry, even more off-putting.
Oh, it's worse. It's worse because, like, you know, like, they like their neighbor. And, like, she's, like, you know, odd because she's a sitcom character. But, you know, they don't want to offend her. So they, like, hear her out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's the worst. Like, you can throw jazz right out the door, but these guys, you got to sit around and like listen to them.
You have to humor them.
Yeah.
So in episode two, we fully established that this is the Seattle area, confirming what I had assumed, and the Pacific Northwest, which is where Newman learned to climb trees.
Yep.
I did laugh at that scene at the beginning where they're having, so Harry has a dream that he wakes up from, and he dreams that he's a businessman having breakfast before going to work, and that he's wearing a shirt and tie and then and sitting at the table with them.
That's a generous reading on the situation, because the way I read that scene was, because Harry's sitting there at the table, so he's daydreaming about killing the dad, replacing him.
Talented Mr. Ripley style.
Yeah, like he's exactly, like he is like, because he's listening to the dad rant and rave about him, and he's like, you know what, with this morning would be a lot better if I just killed eight and became him. and he's like, looking around and he's like, this would be my wife, these would be my children.
Yeah,
he's and like, then the, I would the, read the, rest, the Business Times.
The rest of this family I'm cool with, but this dad, I don't know,
he's gotta go.
I don't know about this guy. There might only be room for one of us here, and I'm like 8 feet tall.
what do you think about like the obvious other trope of like the fact that he likes to eat something that's weird? Like, he eats the ferns.
Obviously.
Yeah.
You gotta. What else is he gonna do?
Because Alf tries to eat the cat, and, like there, every creature that's featured in a, you know, sitcom always has, like, one odd thing that the humans don't want them to eat.
Yeah. There's some pretty good slapstick humor in episode two of him, like, bumping into stuff, and especially, like, him and the dad when they're alone at the house, and the dad's getting increasingly frantic and kind of like snapping at him. And there's a moment that's pretty like, I actually did laugh at when Harry smacks the dad on the back of the head but then turns and bonks his own head on the door frame and goes down like a sack of potatoes. Like, it's a good 1-2 sort of thing.
Well, can't go wrong with the slapstick.
Found some of Aaron's buttons.
Yeah.
You know what?
He loves a good slapstick joke.
You show me a giant guy in an ape costume bonking somebody on the head.
The hardest I've ever seen Aaron laugh was like some... like physical comedy bit on like Broad City years ago. Like it was like a door fell off of a truck or something and Aaron was sent into hysterics. Like
I will have a
well-timed and well-edited like physical comedy bit or like a pratfall.
It's true. When it comes to the premise of a show or character development or plot, I'm the most like high-minded, nitpicky person. But when it comes to pure slapstick, it just gets me. And I don't need...
Homer Simpson in the football in the groin.
Exactly. Exactly. I'm that simple when it comes to slapstick. One of the funniest things I ever laughed at, too, was in Detroiters. We always like to give shout-outs to Detroiters. That scene where they're... trying to smash the window in their office and they're throwing stuff at the glass and nothing's breaking it. And then they go and they pick up a desk and they're taking a run at it with the desk to crash through the glass. But before they make it to the glass, the desk falls apart.
Welcome to another episode of Aaron... tries to describe scenes while like breaking down, wheezing, laughing.
Oh, I gotta watch that after. I love that scene.
Are you gonna be okay, Aaron? You need a break?
Maybe. Okay. Composure.
It would be great if we just ended the episode there.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder why John Lithgow didn't do the show since he was in the movie. And part B of this question.
Are you kidding me? John Lithgow. He was a star.
Sure, but part B of this question is, did that regret lead to him taking the role in Third Rock from the Sun just a few years later?
Well, I would argue that one is a much more prestigious gig than the other.
It turned out to be.
Yeah. But... Well, I mean, one was a network sitcom, and one was a first-run syndicated afternoon children's show with a giant ape.
Well, yes, sure. But my point is just, if the whole thing, like, broadly speaking, he's a movie star, and if he was like, I don't want to do a sitcom, and then a few years later, he's like, actually, I kind of do want to do a sitcom. I just think that's interesting. But you're right. I know. Higher profile. But anyway, when I watch this, I have to think, like, it almost feels as if a bunch of writers and producers went on some huge bender, kind of drunk and or high on drugs, and came up with this concept, signed all the contracts, woke up the next morning forgetting what they had agreed to, just like the dad in this episode waking up the next morning and forgetting that he agreed to a Bigfoot moving in with him. They wake up the next morning and they're like, oh shit, what did we agree to do? And they read the premise and they're like, oh geez, well, we better at least try to do a decent job with it. You know, who can we cast? Who can we get to build the set? Like, let's at least make this good.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like. It feels like a preposterous concept, but like a lot of effort put into the execution.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much.
You know, don't phone it in, no matter what you're doing. Don't phone it in.
Anything worth doing is worth doing well.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that saying actually is specifically about producing a Harry and the Hendersons television program. Yeah.
That might be the origin story of that adage.
It was written above the door in the writer's room. You know? And they would tap it like a real Ted Lasso tap on the way out.
The dad's business job. There's a scene where he's working from home on a computer, and that
very prescient.
Yes,
because I was working from home while watching this.
Yeah. So was I. So contemporary.
Yeah.
So ahead of its time.
I mean, you know, in today's world, you could
so prolific.
Depending on what your job is, you could have stayed home with your Bigfoot. Likely, you know, you just get on the VPN, and then you don't have to worry about the Bigfoot, you know.
Except
putting holes in your wall.
Except nowadays, you'd be on a Zoom call, and you have to worry about
the Bigfoot walking by in the background.
And all of that being said, Dad's breakdown near the end over the pressure to earn a living is actually pretty interesting. Like, it's, you know, usually I complain about these scenes where they laid on kind of dramatically thick mm-hmm. at the end of a sitcom episode early on in a first season where they've barely earned this level of pathos. But in this case, I was like, this is actually, just looking at this as a thought experiment, pretty interesting. Because again, if you ignore the fact that Dad's speech is directed at a Bigfoot and you just listen to what he's saying, for 1991, as like the classic businessman, upper middle class dad mm-hmm. character in a family sitcom, it's like the most critical takedown of like that sort of like working world, work ethic, capitalist sort of thing, trope at that time, where he's like having this stress attack over having to like make this presentation so that he doesn't like lose his job and he can support his family. And he's just going on this whole speech about all the pressure that's on him to like do his job well and everything like this. And it doesn't seem like he even enjoys his work. It's just something he's doing to pay for this whole apparatus that is middle-class life that he's built around himself. And then Harry just like pulls down this tree branch and shows him like an egg hatching in a bird's nest. And he finds it beautiful and he stops, you know, to appreciate the little things and the beauty in the world and all the nature and whatnot. And
I liked that scene too, but the whole time I was very nervous that the mama bird would go kill her new hatchlings because it smelled like a Bigfoot, you know?
Oh, I just thought he was just going to eat them.
That's what you were thinking.
I would have ended the whole damn thing with him just putting them right in there.
That would have been
so traumatic.
Such a good punchline though.
Yeah.
Oh my God. After the dad's touching speech, if Harry just looks at him, winks, and then like wolfs down the entire branch, you're right. That would have fucking crushed. That would have been the punchline to end all.
My other alternate joke would have been in the opening, when he's recounting his dream about, you know, retelling the pilot, I would have done a very dramatic retelling of it. But then when he gets to the point where he says, you know, he hit a Bigfoot, he would say, I hit the Loch Ness Monster. And then we brought the Loch Ness Monster home. And, you know, Loch Ness Monster's living in our house. And then Harry would come in and be, oh, it's just Harry.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that's
it's just a Bigfoot.
Yeah. because I kind of knew going into this that the whole point is that Harry's like the gentle giant trope, which is probably why where my mind went with him sitting at the breakfast table eating with the family was that the joke was that like Harry's fantasizing about what it would be like to live like them, not that he was going to like eat the dad and get him out of the picture, because I just sort of knew going into it like that's a big part of the thing.
Well, clearly, I'm coming in on some weird takes here. Clearly, I came in on this as some pretty dark, dark views on this pilot.
Yeah, you went darker. The lighting, the cinematography in it would lead you to believe that it's a little darker, to be honest. So, Bryn, how do we connect Harry and the Hendersons, the sitcom, with Friends?
Yeah. So a couple different ways. One of them is a One Degree connection.
Oh.
Yeah. The only thing is we didn't meet this character in the episodes that we watched, but it's through the actor Elena Reed Hall, who plays a recurring character in later episodes, obviously, named Lorraine Hall. So she guest starred on Friends. And the second connection is through Bruce Davison, no surprise.
Yeah, because he's been in a thousand things.
He's been in everything. So Bruce Davison co-starred on the show Sybil.
Oh.
So there's, you know, I know we always talk about the...
we should do Sybil. We should do Sybil. I know it ran a while, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing is, we always talk about Mad About You, but there's also quite a few Sybil connections. And the reason why there's a Sybil connection is it's only because of this actor, Dee Dee Pfeiffer. And Dee Dee Pfeiffer had a pretty big role on Sybil, but she was only like in one episode of Friends. So it's kind of random. But I keep coming back to this connection because everybody has been in Sybil and everyone has, or people have co-starred with Dee Dee Pfeiffer and other things.
Right.
So yeah, so that is it that I could find. I checked all the writers, I checked everything else, but from what I could tell, it was those two connections.
All right. That's good. Good, good, good. So what's the spinoff?
I had fun with this one because the cast was very interesting. Like, we'll start with Bruce Davison. As we already said, the guy has not stopped working since he was able to take work in the film and television industry. I'm very enlightened now that I know the name of that one big studio that does all the Mockbusters. So thanks for that, Barry.
But you're welcome.
I just found it very funny that immediately following, or like kind of at the same time that he was in this show, in Harry and the Hendersons, he was in a like film, like this prestige film, one of the first like big films that tackled the AIDS crisis, called Longtime Companion. And he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Nice.
So basically he was in this sitcom and the same year was nominated for an Oscar.
That's great.
Which is very funny.
That's incredible is what that is. Yeah. That's the biggest swing.
I know.
Yeah, and one for prestige, one for the paycheck.
Yeah, totally. And then he was also
This guy knows how to work, eh?
Well, yeah, he does. Yeah. He was also in Shortcuts, the Altman film in 93. So it's basically he would do these random prestige films while being in this schlocky family sitcom.
You know what they call that? Range.
Yeah, exactly. you know, he was also in the first X-Men movie as the Senator Kelly.
My God, he has such a resting senator face.
He played a senator multiple times.
He's got a lot of manic energy to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he's such a straight-laced looking guy, but he can really kind of like, he really has a weird madcapness to him.
Yeah.
You know?
For sure. He played a senator again in Ozark most recently. I noted one of his credits as Titanic 2 because that was like a favorite little gem of mine like years ago. And I made everybody watch it at the height of the pandemic.
God, I wish that was only the second time I saw it and not the third.
Can we get him on our show? Can we try to get him on our show?
I mean, he'll do anything, so maybe.
He seems like he's down for like, whatever.
The thing that concerns me is, like, yeah, he's getting older. Like, he literally does not stop working. Like, does he, like, go from one set to another in the same day? Like, how does that work?
Well, I mean, you gotta remember some of these sets are... I mean, I don't know if you recall his work in Titanic 2, but he's literally just sitting in front of a green screen on a barely there helicopter set.
Yeah. True.
But yeah, I mean, he's capable of doing like these really prestige roles.
Oh, shit. He's also
this schlocky stuff. I want to talk to this guy.
The guy doesn't have a spare minute in the day, man.
No, not at all. So, okay, and so I'll also say two of the other Hendersons, Ernie and the mom, whose name I can't remember right now, but so we've got Zachary Bostrom, who played Ernie. He's had a lot of supporting player and guest star roles in TV in the years since. And again, same with Molly Cheek. One notable role that I thought was kind of interesting is she plays Jim's mom in the American Pie movies. So that's the Jason Biggs character. So that's kind of like a funny little like supporting role that would be very, you know, memorable to our age group. And then we have Carol Ann Merrill, who played Sarah, the teenage daughter. So after Harry and the Hendersons, she had a few other like child like acting roles. Like she was in Grace Under Fire, The George Wendt Show, and Party of Five. But then as an adult, she moved behind the camera and now works as a line producer. So that's kind of cool. David Coburn, who played Walter, the cryptozoologist.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to talk about him. So he's also had a very long and storied career, 102 credits on IMDb. He's been a prolific, both like in front of the camera, like as a, like, you know, a supporting player and a, you know, recurring character, a guest star in so many shows of all genres. He's also been a very prolific voice actor since he was like 21.
Hmm.
He is the voice of Captain Planet.
Huh. Oh, he's a hero.
And apparently, you know, I saw some little reference online to him, like being really into like eco-activism now. So I'm like, was it what came first, the Captain Planet or the, you know,
well,
so kind of cool.
Captain Planet was... was not a passion project for many of those people involved. It was mostly done for, it was a passion. It was more, but it was mostly done as a, for some cases, community service, for some cases to further their own charities. But it was more, it was less of an entertainment show and more of a infotainment where they were basically the money from Captain Planet was coming from like, you know, charity organizations. And
yeah. But that was like such a like big part of our childhood. So.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I feel bad. I want to just say this. You know, 274 acting credits for Bruce Davidson. I was mistaken. He's really only done maybe four or five like Asylum level projects. The shit that he does is, you know, he's done some crap, sure, but who hasn't? But I mean, like, you know, he's still doing a lot of like high profile stuff.
Yeah, totally. No, he is. He's like, he's one of these rare performers.
He crosses streams
and all genres. Literally, yeah, he's done everything.
Movies, television, comedy, drama, all over the place. Really prestige stuff, but also just like entertaining stuff.
Yeah, he's not a snob. He's obviously like a very talented guy and could be more of a snob, but he clearly is just like, whatever. I just like being on set. I just like getting a paycheck and being on set.
He's clearly someone who enjoys the craft because he's clearly going out for more work than he needs to.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's wild. Okay.
Just one more thing. So my favorite Asylum credit that he does have was a movie that he directed and had a role in it for the Asylum. It was called Bigfoot.
he couldn't shake it, you know. It really made an imprinted on him.
Yeah,
you know?
he was like directed it.
You think there was a producer there who was just like, hey, I wonder if we can get ... and then
Or do you think it's more likely that while they're shooting and like, you know, they're waiting for the lights to get set up that like four or five times a day, he's like, you know, one of my first jobs was on a sitcom about Bigfoot. Anyway.
So I'll just kind of call out a couple of the performers who played Harry. So obviously we mentioned, Kevin Peter Hall, who is the original and sadly passed away in 91. But then a couple of other actors kind of stepped in who are also very tall and very, you know, kind of it's an interesting thing. Like all these super tall guys like that are like 7 feet tall. Like that's kind of like what you get the work in these very specific roles because you know, like they need someone that big. So Patrick Penny and DeJuan Scott also played Harry, as well as an actor named Brian Steele. So Brian Steele also played a predator in the Predators movie.
Oh.
So that's a funny parallel because, yeah, as we said, Kevin Peter Hall played Predator, and so did his like predecessor.
Huh.
So he's his predecessor in multiple ways. He also played Bigfoot again in a movie called Exits. So it wasn't the one that, but apparently just Bigfoot just really had an impact on all of these people. And then finally, we have Gigi Rice, who played Samantha, the neighbor and news reporter. She went on soon after this to co-star on the John Larroquette show, which we were all fans of.
Right.
She's fun. I've always enjoyed her. She also was in The Night of the Roxbury. She played one of the it was her and Eliza Donovan. Or Elisa Donovan.
Elisa,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and they were the scheming girls at the nightclub who, you know, at first decide to date the Butabi brothers because they think that they're rich, and then they end up actually liking them or something. I can't remember what the plot is, but now it made me want to watch the Night at the Roxbury. And then, you know, she's had a ton of other guest roles, like, throughout the years. She's just always popping up on our television screens.
She's fun here too.
Pardon? Oh yeah,
she was fun here too.
Totally, yeah, totally. Very had a very fun energy as this character, and it's interesting because, yeah, in the 90s, it was such a trope for there to be a busybody neighbor, and so this is kind of like a bit of a twist on that because she's a busybody in the sense that she's a reporter, so that she has a very specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not your typical, oh, I'm bored and nosy.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a busybody.
Yeah.
I think it's my career to be a busybody.
Yeah, she's professionally digging for information, yeah, and she doesn't...
She's a real take-no-shit feminist. It's great.
Yeah.
Which is not something you would see on TV in, like, 1991.
Especially for family...
Right. There was a line of dialogue that really proved that. There was a specific line.
The cop calls her little lady.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is.
Something like that, and she reacts.
She's like, well, I'm in a, you know, an award. You're that little, the news lady or
that
something like that.
That little lady from the TV
or
something.
And he's like,
well,
I'm an award-winning, like, segment producer for an award, and, you know.
And an adult
a little
woman.
Lady and an adult. And, like, little lady is my four-year-old daughter.
Right, that's what it was. Lady is my four-year-old daughter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a good line.
Yeah. But, you know, we also saw, like, I it's weird because, yeah, we're like, oh, that's unlikely. But then I remember now, Out of This World, the mom character on that show was also a badass, was also like had an empire, basically, like she was
right.
Very. So, yeah. So it's you see it in the odd case of them really wanting to like.
Oh, you see it all the time. Just didn't expect it in Harry and the Hendersons.
Didn't expect some of these layers, not to like overanalyze it or project these ideas where maybe we're just, you know, reading into things. But it does feel like this show has a little bit more commentary about themes from the time than I would have expected, given the premise that a family is living with a Bigfoot. But like, then you're right. Like the nosy neighbor is an award winning journalist. The mom does not like when dad tries to convince everyone else to stay home. Like he tries to convince her to stay home instead of him in episode 2. And she's just like, "Heh, yeah, peace." And she just like leaves. And like his career is not put ahead of hers in that episode. And then there's like his whole speech at the end that I mentioned, which a lot of it kind of gets into commentary on capitalism and the working world and stuff in a way that I wasn't expecting. Like it's a surprising amount.
It's layered. It's layered.
There's a surprising amount of layered for this show.
All right. On that note.
All right. Wait, I had one last leftover. Do either you have any leftovers?
I don't got any. I'm good.
I have one
Hell
last.
No.
You do? No. I had one last. I had one last little leftover. There's a scene in episode 2 where the cryptozoologist has a little video camera and he's trying to, like, for his research, get some video of Harry, but he gets, like, distracted by the family having conversation with him or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he's, like, turning away from Harry toward them to talk, and thus, like, still holding the video camera, but it's, like, not pointed at Bigfoot. And Harry, like, grabs the video camera and, like, shifts it back so that it's pointing at him and starts, like, looking into the camera and, like, kind of mugging for the camera. Like, he wants the attention. Like, he wants to be on video, which I thought was, like, pretty funny. So, just had to say that. It was a charming beat.
Yeah, again, I think if this were now, Harry would be a TikTok star.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't give him any ideas, man.
Well, that was something. So, let's check in with Mr. Producer before we go.
Hey, kid, what's grating your cheese this week?
You've just got a million of those little sayings, don't you? This week, we talked about Harry and the Hendersons.
Oh, yeah, sure. John Lithgow, get out of here. We don't want you. Go home. You know, like, classic picture.
Well, kind of. We're talking about the sitcom they made based on it.
You did what?
They made a sitcom about it.
But no Lithgow.
No Lithgow. Bruce Davison.
Oh, yeah, that's a choice. Lasted a couple episodes?
Actually, it did 3 seasons.
You're kidding me. Who the hell put that on?
It was syndicated, actually. So, you really didn't know about it at the time?
I mean, at the time, sure. I mean, maybe it crossed paths once or twice, but I gotta say, I got nothing on this one.
Oh, that's disappointing.
Actually, no, you know what? Here's a fun one. I once went on a week-long excursion into the Alberta wilderness to find the fabled Bigfoot.
You did?
Yeah. Just me, Matt Bopp, Henry Hill, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Alfonso Ribeiro. After Spoons, but before Prince.
You what?
10 long days just extensively hunting the fabled Sasquatch. Really? Trying to get a sense of them, you know, campfires and baking our own beans, climbing trees, you know, kicking the dirt around, just at one with nature.
And did you see anything?
Kid, I can neither confirm nor deny a thing.
All right, so apparently Mr. Producer saw Bigfoot.
Well, sounds like it. Or maybe.
Probably tried to sign him for a 3-picture deal.
Probably.
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
And he rolls with quite a crew.
Yeah. That Matt Bopp, he's got some stories.
Matt Bopp, all right.
Yeah. Maybe we should try to get Matt Bopp on the line one of these days.
Who knows?
I bet he has good stories about Mr. Producer.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that was our bad adaptation episode about Harry and the Hendersons, whose feet were too big.
Too big.
And cut to credits. That Was a Show is created and hosted by Bryn Burney, Andrew Barry Helmer, and myself, Aaron Yeager. It's a production of Radio Gizmo in Toronto, Canada. Subscribe, rate, review, and share. Follow us on Instagram and tell your friends about it. That Was a Show.
Radio Gizmo.